Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, December 1st, 2007. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Today we're going to discuss a major breakthrough which occurred last weekend at a very significant conference in Los Angeles, a conference on U.S.-China relationship. This was a conference sponsored by several Chinese organizations, and it brought together scholars, including professors and members of think tanks, and activists from mainland China, from Taiwan, and from the United States to discuss how to ensure a peaceful future between the United States and China. There were two special features to this conference. First was the leading role played by Lyndon LaRouche, who spoke at the conference, the press conference, to open the event, and then delivered the keynote address on Saturday at lunch. And secondly, the major coverage given to LaRouche's address, which appeared in the leading newspapers and press services of China, including translations into English, French, German, and Arabic editions, and probably more than that. On the program today, we'll be discussing the substance of Mr. LaRouche's remarks, as well as the significance of the breakthrough in the coverage. And joining us will be Lainey Rubinstein, who is the United Nations correspondent for EIR and has been involved with Mr. LaRouche's work in China for years. Also, we'll be joined by Michael Vandernat from the LaRouche Youth Movement, who participated in the conference. And then later in the program, we'll get a report on the historic hearings on LaRouche's Homeowner and Bank Protection Act, which took place Thursday in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And we'll get that from Mari Navarrete, who is currently in the war room in Leesburg. I just completed an article on the China conference for the EIR, which I titled LaRouche's Intervention as a Historic Breakthrough. I was there along with Lainey, who is a longtime colleague of mine, and Lainey played a key role in making sure this breakthrough occurred. So, Lainey, welcome to the LaRouche Show.
Thank you, Holly.
What I'd like to start with is your report on what is the nature of the breakthrough which occurred in Los Angeles, and give us a little background on the event.
Yeah, I think it's a fun thing in history that here you have sleepy Thanksgiving weekend where everybody is stuffing themselves and real history is being made, where LaRouche has in many interviews and in many discussions and also speeches to the Chinese earlier has taken up the crisis. And let me just give you, but never before has this been brought out in a positive way by the leading government official sponsored news agency, the Xinhua, People's Daily, and China Daily. This is 100% government backed by China, whatever comes out of leading news in those entities, those press entities. So this was what was really a complete shift. In other words, the Chinese decided to play the LaRouche card. And I just wanted to just very briefly take up some of the key things that LaRouche took up from the press conference, the keynote, and from the discussion. And then I would really urge people to otherwise go on our website and study it very carefully themselves. But what did LaRouche bring up? He took up, we have a financial crash, the system is finished, and we are going to hell unless we now negotiate agreements for a solution. And what I suggest, LaRouche said, is that U.S. and China negotiate a treaty agreement where we fix the value of the Chinese currency, the yuan, and the dollar. And when we do that, U.S. and China, then every leading economy in the world will have to join.
Now, Lainey, on that point, one of the things I'd like to make clear to our listeners is that this was a very different message than the Chinese have been getting from the United States. Because what they've been told by the Democrats in the Congress, by Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, by Wall Street, is that China has to continue to take in the increasingly bankrupt dollar and adjust their currency upward to try to help the U.S. dollar. What's the different proposal that LaRouche is making. Why go for a fixed exchange rate?
Well, LaRouche made it clear also earlier in an interview with the EIR, with the Chinese press agency in the EIR from September the 7th, that this is all China bashing. This is all to create a crisis within China, that this will help neither China's economy or the U.S. economy. That instead, and LaRouche here at this conference pointed out that, look, the China holds the biggest amount of U.S. dollar outside the United States. And China is the great, great trade partner with the United States. So if the dollar goes down, then the Chinese yuan goes down, the Chinese people will be cheated of the development that they should have. So what LaRouche proposed was the Chinese should, you have the fixed exchange rates, and the Chinese could use their holdings for investment in internal improvement inside China, and that U.S. could export to China and vice versa. LaRouche has pointed out, too, how that would be great for the American economy. We have a huge collapse in the industrial capacity in U.S., but we still have qualified workers that could jump in with the development inside the United States and inside China. So I just want to make one point which I thought was really beautiful and leads to all kinds of ideas, and that is that at one point regarding this, where U.S. needs China to export to U.S., vice versa, China holding these huge amounts of U.S. dollar, LaRouche said, look, China and the United States are in a complete inseparable relationship. Now we just need to make this legal. We need a legal marriage for the common good, for the advantage of the other. And people got so happy. Harley was there, Mike was there some of the time, and it was visible throughout the weekend how happy the Chinese officials at this conference were to find this solution, that we can turn something awful and dangerous into something very good.
Yeah, like I think that's a very important
economic
point.
Development.
That's a very important point that Lin kept talking about, the interdependence mm-hmm. of China and the United States. And he talked about them as interdependent not because of so-called globalization, but as two sovereign nation states which have mutual interests in the development of the other, the Peace of Westphalia principle. And I think this is something which most Americans have no conception of, because we're all victimized by this incessant line that the Chinese are a threat to us. They're trying to build up their economy, to build up their military. The other question that came up, Lainey, was the China-Taiwan relationship. And on this, there were some very important things said by the Chinese consul general, which also reflected what Lin said. I wonder if you could just give a quick report on that.
Well, he said, look, the U.S. government's policy regarding the Taiwan question, this is ambiguous, and it will harm the United States. And he also said that we really hope, very, very truthfully, we hope that U.S. government will learn lessons from its previous mistakes, because, as he pointed out, China is no longer what it was before. So he was very clear that no more.
And then on this question as well, there were a number of groups, including a large turnout from San Francisco and others, of Chinese who live in the United States, who were also very happy with Mr. LaRouche's intervention. Now, I think to get at this a little deeper, why this is a breakthrough, the Chinese policy until recently has been, at least seemingly, to try and just go along with the benefits from globalization. To what extent has this created a problem for China, Lainey, and how does Mr. LaRouche's solution offer them a way out of what otherwise would be a confrontation?
Well, the problem for China is that they have spent a lot of money to provide infrastructure in specific areas, mostly along the coast, and tax breaks and so forth for foreign companies. That is, providing water, electricity, roads, and so forth, and for foreign companies to set up shop in China. And then they have this where they do it for 10 years and then transfer it into Chinese hands, but where you have very low salaries, very cheap labor, working very hard to produce products that are then being sent out of the of China, but very little investment, with very little benefit for China itself. So what there's a shift now, particularly with the present government of Hu Jintao, the president of China, where he, with the seventh, the latest Congress that just took place, Party Congress, the 17th Congress, where there's a clear shift to have a development inland in China, to have a program for the dental welfare of the population at large, to develop inland. Indeed, there's a plan to have 12,000 kilometers of express rail lines by the year 2020, developing inland, upland, with water management, rail lines, water management, roads, power plants, nuclear power plants, and so forth. And I really want to point out one thing, which to see how beautiful this marriage can be between China and U.S., the way LaRouche describes it. The Chinese has a saying, has a word for crisis, which is weiji, which means danger and opportunity. If we get China and America legally married, then what we're going to have is a development from the two Koreas now approaching each other, China with a massive internal development, the development of the whole Tumen area, which is the 10,000 square kilometers between Korea, Russia, and China, the border of these three nations. The Russians are now moving in connection with this to build 6,000 kilometers of rail from the Trans-Siberian Railroad up into the Bering Strait. And then a connection over the Bering Strait in through Alaska, Canada, all the west coast of the United States into Mexico, and of course from there across the United States. So what was brought up too at this conference and discussions was the not only railroads in this connection, but also the water management, the old NAVAPA program from the 1960s when there was an optimism in America, spanning from the north all the way down to Mexico. So we begin to see how we can have a collaboration of mutual advantage around the Pacific, which would just be a center for power for good, for economic development for good, for the rest of Asia, spanning into Europe and the United States and into South America. So that is the marriage. That's the alternative that LaRouche is talking about.
Now, also, Mr. LaRouche spoke about, in the context of this development, joint development perspective, he took this back to the Franklin Roosevelt policy, the intention of Franklin Roosevelt at the end of World War II to ensure that not only that colonialism was eradicated as a policy for keeping nations underdeveloped, but it would be replaced by this kind of development. To what extent do you think, we know in Russia with Putin and others, there's been a lot of discussion of Franklin Roosevelt recently, to what extent are the Chinese aware of this idea that this is not something that Mr. LaRouche just invented, but he's advanced a conception that was already there with Franklin Roosevelt?
I think it's a question about an education question. I think already that there's a lot of discussions of Roosevelt's New Deal in Beijing, but still much more needs to be done. But part of that is a revival of Dr. Sun Yat-sen, the gentleman and revolutionary hero who led the revolution overthrowing the Emperor of China. And Sun Yat-sen's three principles of the people, that is the sovereignty of the nation state, the sovereignty of the individual, and the general welfare, which three principles he took from Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address. This is being discussed. I mean, last year there was a huge conference organized personally by the president Hu Jintao of China to to celebrate those ideas of Dr. Sun Yat-sen. So this among the elite in China is definitely spreading.
I think,
and
also
then, of course, with using LaRouche is a beautiful way, perfect way of teaching about the real America.
Well, and Sun Yat-sen, as I recall from a class you gave not that long ago, Sun Yat-sen was a great believer in developing the interior of China with railroads and other kinds of major projects.
Yes, as well as developing Africa, which is a point that Helga LaRouche took up in her speech at the conference, and which LaRouche has taken up a number of times, that we look at two key regions of the world in this century ahead, and that is Asia and Africa. And Sun Yat-sen took the whole thing.
Well, it's interesting then, because what you have from LaRouche's perspective is the United States, which instead of serving alongside the city of London as an enforcer of a new kind of Anglo-Dutch empire, LaRouche's proposal is that the United States change its policy to form alliances with sovereign nation states, particularly Russia, China, and India, his so-called Four Powers Agreement, and begin a process of transforming the monetary system, getting back to a new Bretton Woods, and taking that on as a development perspective. So, Lainey, why is it that all we hear from the Congress is that China's a threat, China's a danger? You have Duncan Hunter now, who's supposedly a candidate for president on the Republican side, but I'm not even sure he pops up at 1% in the polls. But Hunter came out warning that China's carrying out military threats to us by not allowing U.S. ships to dock at Hong Kong. Why is it that we always hear this other side from China, from U.S. politicians on China?
Well, it's a combination. Some of them are stupid, and some of them are controlled by money. Rohatyn and Schultz are behind this control. And then you have some of them are consciously or unconsciously working on behalf of the British, who to this day has wanted not only to destroy the United States, but to destroy China. And China and U.S. are historically very, very close allies and friends situated around the Pacific. And that is the real American system idea of collaboration around common interests, and that is Roosevelt again. So they are really working not just against China's interest, but against that of the United States as well.
Let me bring in Michael Vandernat, who's a member of the LaRouche Youth Movement, who I know at times has been studying geopolitics and also, I believe, studying Chinese. Michael, you had a chance to attend the conference, at least parts of it. What was your impression on the importance of Lyndon LaRouche's intervention into the U.S.-China question?
Well, I could say that it was certainly the most active part of that conference. I never went to a Taiwan relations-based seminar before, but a lot of the speeches by the Chinese were now, I don't want to say redundant, but they're very narrowly focused on Taiwan. But then when LaRouche came into the luncheon, and then afterward we had a sort of workshop with you and Lainey, that all the fireworks were coming off of the discussion about globalization, about the dollar collapse, and primarily around the role of the British and the United States going for war, you know, and targeting China, targeting Russia. So that was very explosive. So.
And you had a chance to talk with some of the Chinese participants. How did you find their interest in the fact that we had members of the LaRouche Youth Movement there?
You know, they kept congratulating us on the singing. You know, Lainey thought it was a good idea if we opened up with some music. And, you know, she really wanted to give them the impression that we are very different youth here in the United States, very exceptional youth. And you know, the singing was decent, but these guys were totally excited about it. Even at the banquet on Saturday night, similar comments were coming off the floor. You know, you guys are really great.
What did you sing?
We opened up with the Ave Verum Corpus. That's by Mozart. And it was followed by a spiritual and a canon.
Mm-hmm. So, and Michael, from your understanding of what Lainey was just discussing, How many people, when you go out on a campus and you talk about China, what's the response you get?
You know, I'm not sure. I'm not sure how much the American youth really follow these huge, you know, like you said, geopolitical or international relations. I think they might have their attention focused on these video games. So we're working on that.
So we have to do a real education program on the American campuses, because sometimes the media talks about this as the Pacific century, the emergence of China, and I think it's somewhat muddled in most people's minds. Maybe they confuse it with Japanese video games or something.
Right, yeah, right, exactly.
So, Lainey, now, the follow-up on this, or actually, let me go to something that sort of precedes this. You were involved with Mrs. LaRouche in quite a bit of organizing in the early 90s on the idea of the land bridge, which somewhat got off the radar screen for a while. Does this bring this whole question of the connection of Europe and Asia with high-speed rail systems and trade connections and corridors of development, is this now back on the agenda?
Absolutely. And it's actually, this is one thing that people in Central Asia and in China has, and of course Russia has, really has wanted and has worked on in all these years too. It's just, what about the United States? What about the international financial system? And therefore, one of the things that shows really how China really wants this is China has had a tremendous emphasis on the development of the western part of China, which goes into Central Asia and then over towards Europe. China has also been the key country in the world that has been begun to take care of development of Africa in terms of education, know-how, and so on, including building of the research nuclear reactors and so on. The big problem has been that Europe and the United States are going to hell. So therefore, the relief and the optimism that LaRouche has a solution. And I just want, because of this, what Mike said too, that people don't really understand it. Many young people and others in America really do not really understand what this is all about. Think about how we are using many, many billions, hundreds of billions of dollars to bail out the bankrupt financial system, where when LaRouche talks about let's make the credit system government-controlled and let China issue credit, U.S. issue credit, Russia, and so on, for these great development programs. Then think back about how excited people must have been when the Golden Gate Bridge went up, when the Hoover Dam went up, the Washington Bridge, the Tribor Bridge, and whatnot. And think about how this will be peanuts throughout Eurasia, throughout the Americas, if we go with LaRouche and the American system. And that's what we are looking at. We are looking at either hell or a complete new future for the next 50, 100, 200 years ahead, where we're going to make the foundation the next 50 years ahead. And this is what the implication of the Chinese breaking out and publicly playing the LaRouche card, this is the significance that we can fully go with it. If we have the United States as part, together with Russia, India, and China, but also just as LaRouche pointed out, just if China and the United States goes together, then the rest of the world will follow. And then there is no limit to what we can do regarding economic development throughout Eurasia and spanning through Africa down to South America. Absolutely no limit.
Well, one of the terms that I heard from a number of the Chinese delegates at the conference was optimism.
Mm-hmm.
Because prior to hearing Mr. LaRouche, many of them were responding from a defensive standpoint. Is there anything we can do to stop the United States from threatening China? Is there anything we can do to stop Taiwan from being used as a bargaining chip or as a launch point for war? And all of a sudden, after Mr. LaRouche spoke, what was put on the table is there's another option. The Chinese and the United States have a common purpose. Again, this idea of interdependence. See, one of the things that I think people don't understand is that if the Chinese decided that the dollar was no longer worth protecting, that is, they're holding so many of them, if the Chinese decided to dump it, this would have a profoundly negative effect on the dollar, but it would also have a profoundly negative effect on China.
Yes.
And so the one weapon that the Chinese seem to have is one which has a dual purpose, in a sense. It could go in either direction. And so what Mr. LaRouche put on the table now is that there is another alternative, which is collaboration. And, of course, I think this is especially important because if you look in the United States today, I was even watching on Fox News this morning, and even the idiots on Fox Business Channel couldn't spin the economy to sound good. They were saying, look, the Dow Jones may go up a little bit next week if Bernanke lowers interest rates, but we're in a crisis. What are we going to do about the billions of dollars the banks are losing? And so it's in both nations' interest to have a change. Let me remind our listeners that you're listening to The LaRouche Show. We're live on the Internet every Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. You can find us on the website at LaRouchePub.com. I'd also encourage people to go onto the LaRouche PAC website. I think many of our listeners have been doing this, and you find that two or three or even four times a day we have updates. You can get the updates, including some of the speeches Mr. LaRouche gave, some of the press coverage. So LaRouchePAC.com is the place to go for updates. Now, this next week, we're coming out with a special double issue of the Executive Intelligence Review, which will include all the coverage of the China-U.S. event in Los Angeles, some of the background to it, as well as the text of Mr. LaRouche's speech, the questions and answers at the speech, which are also just fascinating, and as well as the press conference and some other analysis. Now, I'd like to bring on now Lamari Navarrete, who's in the war room. Lamari was at an event yesterday as part of this battle, this global battle on finances. Lyndon LaRouche has initiated a bill, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, the Homeowner and Bank Protection Act. Before we get into the report on Harrisburg, there's been an enormous amount of expanded activity this week, I understand, Lamari, in terms of other city councils and other kinds of motion. Why don't you bring us up to date on the motion behind it and then give us a report on what happened in Harrisburg on Thursday?
Well, what I could say right now is that we have, at this moment, 17 city councils that have passed the HBPA, calling upon the federal government to act to, you know, introduce a moratorium on foreclosures and stop, you know, the collapse of the banking system. But what I think is most significant is what we have in Pennsylvania and what this hearing represented, because you didn't have a whole series of disconnected events taking place where, you know, one city council thought it would be a good idea on this part of the state, and then on the other side of the state, another city council, completely separate, decided to do it as well. But instead, you had a lot of this activity in Pennsylvania where you now have 12 city councils who have passed it, including Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. This activity is emanating from the organizing that we've done, and especially with Harold James, who is a close collaborator with our movement and has been organizing.
He's a state representative from Philadelphia.
Right, exactly. And so I think that's one of the most significant things, because this is the area where we've had the most level of activity and movement on this.
Then on Thursday, there were hearings sponsored by Harold James, who has a resolution before the Pennsylvania legislature. And this is a resolution that I think has 40-something co-sponsors. So how did the hearings go?
Well, great. First of all, it was on the Intergovernmental Affairs Committee, which Harold's not a part of, but that's where the legislation was discussed. And it's actually a resolution calling upon the federal Congress to act. And it was a packed hearing, which was interesting, not only from the public end, but also there were many legislators who showed up, despite the fact that the State House is not in session at the moment. Now, Harold's testimony, to begin with, he invoked the spirit of 1776 in the beginning. And he made the point that this really is a banking crisis and that we need to save these federally chartered banks. He said the situation would become worse than the Great Depression, and that the dollar is falling to record lows, and that the Federal Reserve, you know, keep trying to bail these banks out. And he made it clear that, you know, we need a firewall to protect the banks, and we need also a second one to prevent millions of evictions. And also made it clear that this legislation is coming directly from Lyndon LaRouche. Now, the interesting thing is that the first person then who went up to testify after Harold was the Secretary of Banking for the state of Pennsylvania, which was not so interesting, given that this is, he's, you know, putting out some of the same lines that have been coming out from Congress, such as from Representative, you know, Barney Frank. Like, maybe we can somehow create a scheme to maybe in the future keep people in their homes. Or maybe we can create some sort of ability to, you know, help people understand how these adjustable mortgages work, you know, so on, et cetera. But what Paul Gallagher, who is actually a colleague of Lyndon LaRouche, what he said is that this is not a housing crisis, but a banking crisis. And that you have a mortgage bubble right now of over $20 trillion, which has blown up over a very short period of time. And you have to recognize that the banks right now have 50% of their assets tied up into this mortgage bubble. Now, you have a lot of people, he said, that think that it's not so bad. But if you look at, for instance, a report that was put out from First American CoreLogic, he said that just a 10% drop in the medium home prices, which actually is being triggered by the blowout of these subprimes, which people say is a very small percentage, so-called. But the 10% drop in median home prices has caused 39% of those mortgages originated in 2006 to go upside down, where the mortgage debt is actually greater than the home value. And now, so if you think about what we're going into right now, in 2008, we're looking at nearly 2 million adjustable rate mortgages resetting to higher rates and payments. And he emphasized the need for a national mortgage foreclosure holiday. And so through this, you would be able to have a process of determination of the fair, you know, rent equivalents that people can pay. So what was also very important that he brought up is that, you know, look, this isn't a bailout for, you know, just any bank that's been involved in speculative activity based on mortgage-backed securities, say. And that an institution such as Countrywide Financial Corporation, which has received $51 billion since September from the Federal Home Loan Bank, you know, despite this, they've already shrunk their mortgage lending by 40% and laid off 17,000 employees. So you have a situation where you have institutions such as this, which are being bailed out on a massive scale, with billions of dollars. You also have billions and billions pumped into the system from the Federal Reserve. It's absolutely doing nothing to help the American population keep people in their homes. And actually, this banking blowout is continuing.
So what was the response from the representatives who were attending? Was there interest in these questions? Because clearly, I know Representative James introduced the letter from the chairman of the City Council of Philadelphia. I mean, you think Philadelphia and Pittsburgh are the two biggest cities in the state. Clearly, this is now front and center on the minds of people in Pennsylvania because of some of the scandals, the housing shutdown. So what do you think are the possibilities that this will be passed?
I think it's absolutely possible. From what I've seen and what I've learned just about some of the history of some of our involvement with the political community of Pennsylvania. Now, Although some of the representatives may not have been clear exactly, say, the economics, right? That's clear. I mean, a lot of people don't understand physical economy. And it was clear from some of the questions, you know, that were asked. However, there is a sense that there needs to be an educational process that takes place, you know, that we're going to actually follow up on. But by the end of the hearing, the chair of the committee did say, this is something we are going to move on, right? We are going to have a vote. It wasn't clear at the beginning of this that this would happen, but it was clear that the hearing taking place had a historical precedent. You know, you never had LaRouche legislation debated in any state house.
Well, now I think this is interesting because this brings us back to the first topic we were talking about when we characterized the China developments as a breakthrough. I think the Pennsylvania hearing is another form of breakthrough. So let me go back to Laney, who's been, like myself, an old hand in these politics for a long time. It does begin to appear, Laney, as though we're seeing a sea change politically with a potential for dramatic transformation, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And this is what LaRouche has been at now for 4 decades. And therefore, I think that people that are listening in and their friends and people that they talk with should study and organize like never before, because now we can get the America of Lincoln and Roosevelt and LaRouche. We can actually get it now, and we can get a total change for the world at large. We have an opportunity now, and we should fight like hell.
And, Michael, we had a conference yesterday in Los Angeles on the question of developing this infrastructure perspective in the United States. Hal Cooper, who's been on this program before, a very well-known expert in infrastructure. Michael, can you give us a quick report on the conference?
Yeah, we had a fun time. It was, you know, Hal Cooper, the engineer, the authority on maglev, with all of his maps of California and North America. He went through, quickly went through some of the proposals of the rail and why you'd have to go through coastal cities and why you have to go through this area and what cities make sense to link up and where the tunnels should be made. But he would always come back, every point that he wanted to make, he would always come back to the political economic situation. He would talk about how none of these things are being implemented, or that we're taking a big loss on something because we're not listening to LaRouche. You know, he was very focused on these political objectives. You know, and he was fresh from Sacramento, where he was organizing with the Bay Area limb. The youth up there were talking to the assemblymen. You know, in the context of this whole housing crash and their emergency session that's now going to open, they were talking about the kind of infrastructure that would be needed to drive the reforms. Once you freeze and put up the firewall, you know, you have to direct the credit to the right areas. You're just freezing everything doesn't solve the problem. But it's what we should have been doing all along. And so it went very well. It was sponsored by the Franklin Roosevelt Legacy Club. And so it hung together very well, because, you know, Ken Schultz came up from General Atomics. He was briefing us on the next generation of nuclear power. He talked about how there are people who will be fussy and hype up the threats of nuclear power, which are all bunk. And he kind of made a comparison that the early days of aircraft, you know, commercial aircraft, you know, the planes that they use work fine, but you would never use those planes from the 1950s and so forth that opened the commercial aircraft industry. So now we're looking at, you know, controlled fusion and the different types of cooling methods that they have for the existing fission plants, but really wanted to talk about hydrogen fuel cells, getting away from oil, And so he and Hal were kind of going back and forth during the the wrap up, and they're, you know, these guys are, you could say, masters of their field. They've been in their respective fields for a long time, and they're very excited about the fact that we are now making this a political fight. You know, these are people that have had their battles with their, like I said, inside their industries, but maybe at times they have been ignored politically. You know, Ken was talking about how right now people are not talking about nuclear so much. But what's been going on is they've been quietly producing lots of electricity, lots of energy, which, you know, he was very pleased with. But, you know, now these guys are stepping it up and being integrated into a political battle with the LIM. And so, yeah, Hal is pumped up.
Well, this is quite exciting because Lynn, of course, always talks about how the baby boomers screwed up everything with the anti-science of the 68er generation. And I think it's interesting that you have people around like Hal Cooper, this fellow from General Atomics, who have been somewhat pushed aside in the last 20 years with environmentalism, that it's somehow going to harm the planet if you put a railroad up. And, of course, Lainey, this then gets back to the question of China's economic development. Sarkozy was in China recently and signed a major contract, but there's been some flack over Angela Merkel and Germany, and since you've been involved also in Europe with the tremendous prospects in Denmark and the fight in Germany to suppress all technology, again, do you think that we're at a point where this can be overturned by bringing the young generation in?
Yes, and I actually think that it was reflected in a report we got today from Germany, where a organization, I forgot the exact name now, this is the German Psychotherapist, yeah, which is the biggest organization of its kind in Europe. And they came out calling for a total ban against violent computer games. And, no computer games for Christmas, stop it, total ban, that this goes against the image of man. We had just, some of the young people in Germany had just been at a conference by this organization just a week ago, because the way history is functioning, particularly with these big upheavals that we have today, is that the developments as coming out of Russia, China, Denmark, our interventions, the power of ideas begin to have a, it has an, un, it's unseen, but it has an effect that can change world history dramatically. And I think the best example is really the history of the United States with the fight just for the nation leading up to the Declaration of Independence, where how many times did it look like George Washington couldn't make it? Or you think about the times of Lincoln, where we were just about to lose the United States. And a combination of forces and political organizing and leadership made it so that everything was changed. And I think we are in a similar situation worldwide today, that with a little bit of luck and a lot of hard work, and then the ideas on the highest level, we are in such a crisis worldwide that people that did not want to move before, or was too scared to move, or didn't really believe that it could be that bad, they will now be forced to move. The developments of history, and very much because of what LaRouche has come out both warning about the crisis for many years and also coming out providing the solutions, we are in a situation now where we can actually have a worldwide total shift. And this is what we are looking at, and that's why nobody should hold back anything. We should move very, very fast.
And this is the question again of optimism and
yeah,
giving people a sense, especially young people, of the tremendous potential. I mean, I was struck when I heard Lynn speaking at this luncheon, and one of the questions, the first two questions, you had a very important Chinese official who said, "I admire you very much, Mr. LaRouche, and have for a long time, but is there really any force on the planet that can get a change?" And Lin went through the question of China and U.S. again, that how that alliance would work. So then the next question was, well, how do you change the government in the United States? What about the parties in the United States? And Lin made this beautiful point about how 80% of the U.S. population is suffering because of the policies of the last 36 years, especially in the most recent period. And this brings me really to, I wanted to give Lamari an opportunity to discuss from the center what we're doing on this, because the youth who should be the most optimistic, because their whole future is ahead of them, the whole potential to participate in these great projects and great ideas, which include space colonization. And I might add that China has a lunar module now circulating the moon, you know, it's circumnavigating the moon. So the Chinese have a space program that's very reminiscent of what we had back in the 60s. So, Lamari, we're going to take some action to try and free the youth from this grip of a cyber control. What are we doing on this?
Well, we have just released, it's out on the internet and it's arrived already in some locals, a pamphlet called The Noosphere versus the Blogosphere. Is the devil in your laptop? And essentially it's a report which highlights, it does focus on the internet culture of today, but it's really going through how it's being used to actually, as a form of social control, to create a social map of the population at large and to control the population, which has been largely a British tactic going back centuries. And so the first part is a conceptual review of this, of how this has come about through historically. Second part, the specifics on what's being done to the population. And then thirdly, you know, what the idea of a computer should be, going back to Vannevar Bush. Now, what we've seen largely is a lot of inactivity politically from the youth today. And it's gotten largely worse within the past, I would say, I don't know, 5 years, since 2000, on the level of, or the amount of video games that youth are playing, the amount of time they're spending on the internet, to the point that people are turning into zombies or losing their humanity in the sense. No connection or compassion anymore for humanity. So, and this became very clear in our organizing that young people don't have any clue, like, you know, Mike said earlier, about what's happening in China, you know, what's happening in Russia, what their connection is to history. So it became clear that unless we actually did a thorough investigation and went after the corruption that was created through, you know, the Bill Gates internet culture, unless we actually attack that we're not going to get anywhere politically with the youth generation, and that we would actually lose the youth generation. It would be a lost generation. So we put this report together with that in mind. Interestingly enough is that yesterday, the very first deployment we've had of this pamphlet was in Houston, at the University of Houston, where we got it about 500 copies. And what was remarked from the Houston limb was that, look, we never gotten out a pamphlet where you would hand it to somebody, and as the instant they got it, they would start reading it. And even if they were walking away from you because they had class or were busy, they continue to read it. And so what we're already seeing is that it's hitting a huge nerve with among the young people.
So we've got to break the grip of this kind of mindless attachment to MySpace, Facebook, virtual reality. Michael, you said we haven't gotten this yet on the West Coast, but I assume you're mapping out plans for mass circulation there.
Yeah, it's on its way right now, and we'll have it by this afternoon. We'll be doing a kind of all-in deployment to a popular hangout on the west side here in Los Angeles.
Well, make sure our buddies up in Oakland get some of them into Silicon Valley. I'd be interested in getting the response from there where this whole internet revolution, so-called, was launched. So we have about 10 minutes left, and I'd like to pick up some of the implications of what we've been discussing today. Let me come back to Lainey. It's clear now that this is a new factor that's been introduced in global politics, the LaRouche proposal for a new Bretton Woods. And I know that we have, in the weeks ahead, we're watching as the financial system is coming down chunks at a time. From your discussion with your friends in China, to what extent have they concluded now that their hopes that somehow things would work out fine with globalization, to what extent do they now acknowledge that the system is coming down and we do need an alternative?
To what I have the privilege to know, I know that there are certain key levels of people that know that this is extremely dangerous. But I also was informed that people in the elite in China are very, very happy with how blunt LaRouche was warning about this crisis. And, of course, that this was publicized, that his warning was positively publicized and his solution to it was publicized by the Xinhua, the official Chinese government press agency. Because, as they told us, now that means that the officials in China that are not still really fully understanding this, this can be used now as a vehicle to educate them and push this further. And I want to again repeat what we talked about earlier. We have gotten so many positive responses back from this conference that actually, just a matter of fact, 2 minutes ago, I got a call from one of the Chinese participants. I told him, I'm on a radio show, I'll call you back. The new...
You have to turn off your cell phone.
Yeah, I know. With new developments concerning feedback, very positive feedback. And then, again, as we talked about before, what people have been very, very excited about has been the idea of the... Instead of China being looked upon as a danger, a yellow peril or whatever from the side of U.S., and vice versa, China being scared of U.S., we could have the idea about the advantage of the other. It's a total like turning things upside down the way they should be, and this is how LaRouche did it. Very similar, it struck me, to when LaRouche in the 80s told the countries, the leaders of Ibero-America, use your debt as a weapon, use the debt bar, and turn it upside down. And that's what LaRouche has done today, too, to turn this potential hell into an incredible advantage.
Well, what I've seen also from talking to key people in the Democratic Party, who up to this point had been going along with the line that, well, maybe it's not entirely China's fault, but China is, after all, a problem. In fact, a lot of people in the labor movement blame the Chinese for the cheap labor, which has led to the loss of jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's hardly the fault of the poor peasant from central China who's migrated to the coastline to work at a minimum wage. That was actually a policy of the British banking system called free trade that the United States has embraced. So I think that what we're seeing, the other point Lynn made, is that for 37 years, going back to August 15th, 1971, we've had the wrong policy. And we went with deregulation, we went with privatization, with free trade, with development of one financial bubble after another. And now with the collapse of the real estate markets, we're seeing the last bubble pop. And what do you find when a bubble pops? There's no physical economy left in the United States. There's only debt. And so this is not just an opportunity to possibly avoid a war with China. It's an opportunity for us to get back to the right kind of policies. Now, I'm assuming that once we wean some people off the internet and get them to realize that some of these games they play, like World of Warcraft and things of that sort, are not really as exciting as the prospects of transforming the planet. So, Lamari, what are the... I'd like to get from you both what the plans are in terms of the follow-up to the Pennsylvania hearings and then how we're going to move with this computer fight.
Well, first of all, I think the follow-up is that this has to go to the federal level. That, come on, you got 12 cities backing the HVPA. Why aren't one of these guys in Congress taking it up? You know, we've had interesting encounters. You know, one congressman, actually many, when you ask them, endorses, say, well, is this other guy endorsing it? No. And it's like, what about you? well, let me get this other guy to do it before I do. And, you know, there's a lot of cowardice because it's, they know they're taking on something big. But I think the follow-up should be that this thing, yeah, we continue on this thing in Pennsylvania. We continue to make breakthroughs in other states, and that we continually more and more get the population involved, get the youth involved. And that's the key here with to why we need to get this pamphlet out onto the campuses. Because if historically the youth movement has had huge deployments, such as is the Goebbels on your campus pamphlet, which we got out, going through the campus Gestapo, suppressing ideas and political activity, that created a real stir among college students, which led to a lot more political activity and in turn a Democratic majority.
Yeah, that was right before the November 2006 elections, where we introduced what LaRouche called the new politics through the activation of the youth. So you can see something even on a bigger scale now.
Yeah, and it's very important to note that we don't have a youth movement in Philadelphia anymore, but we had one going back in 2003 and 2000 up to 2004. And that was what had laid the basis for this type of political outreach, where you still have our contacts from those deployments who are involved in creating, who were involved in creating this hearing in Harrisburg. So it was part of that youth deployment. Now, if you think about what we're going into with the presidential election, we're getting this pamphlet out in a very timely period of time, right? Because we are going into the very first primaries in January. You know, we're going to a huge blowout of the financial system in 2008. And, well, it's already taking place, but it's being more and more revealed, I guess, to people who are in denial. But this is very important for the youth, because this is what they've made their identity, being on the internet and playing, you know, video games. And so I think that what we are going to do is return to many of the campuses where we distributed widely the Goebbels on your campus pamphlet, and where specifically where we've already had a certain readership. And it's actually going to have a much more powerful effect than even the Goebbels on your campus pamphlet.
And Michael, and we have just a couple of minutes, so let me give you a minute. You expect that we can get these chilled out California virtual reality dudes into the real world?
Yeah. You know, I'm reminded there was an article you wrote a few years ago called Who Owns Your Culture? You know, and in those days, in the earlier days with our youth movement, if we went out and challenged people on their rap music or something, you know, they would hit the ceiling. But this is a little bit beyond rap music. This is affecting millions. I mean, this is almost everyone in our generation, you know, and because if it's not the video game, maybe they're not, you know, hooked up on video games all the time, but then it's MySpace, and if it's not MySpace, it's something else, you know. So this is, like Lamari is saying, this is very deep. This is going to rattle our generation.
Well, Lamari, if people want, they can download this from the LaRouche Pack website, can't they?
Yeah, it's on the homepage of the LPAC website.
Okay, so if you go to LaRouchePAC.com and you look, and I think it's identified as from or the Noosphere versus the Blogosphere, you can find it. You should read it. Now, then you can call in and get the pamphlet or send an email to the website and tell them you want X numbers of copies of the pamphlets, because we want to saturate this. And not only the youth, what about these poor parents, these poor boomer grandparents and tweener parents who can't talk to their kids because they're always on the internet? Here's an opportunity for you to find out what's gotten into your sons or daughters' heads. So I think this is an explosive campaign. You put this together with the breakthrough in Los Angeles on U.S.-China policy and the breakthrough in Harrisburg yesterday, and I think we can begin to see how, as we're coming into a new year, the year 2008 can be the year of LaRouche and transformation of the world economy and a new future for the human race. So I'd like to thank Lainey Rubenstein for being with us today, and also Lamari and Michael. And thanks for joining us on The LaRouche Show. We will be back again next Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time.